listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that, well, is not going to mandate Andrew or I return to work. I'm Scott Phillips. He is Andrew, the aforementioned Andrew, the one and only Andrew Page Esquire. Ram, how are you?
I'm very good, sir. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well. Life is good. It's been a busy old week, as they kind of are at the moment. Not a lot of corporate news around, but plenty of stuff actually going on. Before we do, we kind of buried the lead last week. So I want to put this one up front and center. We're recording a podcast next week live. You're coming up to the Gold Coast. I'm going up to the Gold Coast. We are going to be recording a live, in fact, two live episodes of Motley Fool Money in front of, as they say in the classics, a live studio audience. Feels like Sale of the Century or Sons and Daughters. We are going to be filming in front of a live studio audience when we record Motley Fool Money. So this week, you're at your place, I'm at my place. Next week, we are going to be sitting across from each other, hopefully not disappointing our, well, two or three people who turn up. But we are inviting our listeners to come and join us for the podcast. Now, if you are on the Gold Coast or are going to be on the Gold Coast next Wednesday, the 27th of March, if you listen to this after that, don't turn up in a week's time because we won't be there. 27th of March, we will be on the Gold Coast. Now, there's lots and lots of details to go through. It's a Wednesday evening, so it's after work. If you're going to, you've got work to do, or maybe you're living locally and you want to kind of roll around to where we'll be, just go to fool.com.au/money. All of the details are there. We're having it at, well, some would say appropriately, at a brewery, or at least a microbrewery, a little craft brewery. You can buy yourself a beer after the pod, or even maybe at intermission. So if you're not there for us, go there for the beer. But come along. We'd love to talk to you. We'd love to meet you. We will do a mailbag episode, and we'll take some of those questions at least from our audience live. We might not take the question live, but we'll ask them in advance. If they've got some questions for us, we'll get you to write them down. And we'll collect those and try and get through some of those questions. So if you always had a question for Andrew, if you're still wondering what Bitcoin is, I won't ask that one, but Andrew can go and take a group into the corner and talk to them about Bitcoin. But otherwise, if you want to come and see it being recorded live, meet some other listeners, just have a night out on a Wednesday night on the Gold Coast, please, please come along, fool.com.au/money. It's going to be lots and lots of fun, mate.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. Although I can't let it slip that you referenced Sale of the Century and Sons and Daughters, which I think 80% of listeners are going to go, what's that?
That's also true. I was only thinking about this the other day, mate. As I get older, my pop culture references haven't changed. And so I just confuse more and more people. I work with people, the vast bulk of whom are now younger than me. And I mean something, I get a couple of smiles from a couple of older people and the young ones look at me like, what are you talking about? What is that? I have nothing. I can't. I have no Taylor Swift references. I have no Britney Spears references. Even Britney's old these days. I have no. Who are the cool kids these days, mate? I do TikTok. So yes, I don't get their references. They don't get mine. Tay Tay. Yeah. So they can all get off my grass. I'm much more the. I'm becoming Clint Eastwood in Gran Torino. It's looking a little bit ugly. Yes. No. You remember the voiceover that those episodes, right?
Oh, yeah, hell yeah.
Sons and Daughters were filmed in front of a live studio audience. That was kind of the... I don't know if they do that anymore. Maybe they do. It's hard to know.
I don't know. And then that kind of gradually got replaced by the laugh track, didn't it? And then...
Yeah, didn't it?
Then the audience just disappeared. Yeah.
And now they're just... Now it's just reality TV and math.
Now it's reality TV, yeah.
Can I tell you, I'm pretty happy about this. Not even close to related to a podcast. I have not seen a single minute of Married at First Sight.
Neither have I.
How good's that?
Yeah. I assume it's good.
I'm happy with that.
I'm happy to not know. Yeah.
I've seen the promos, so suffice it to say, if you've seen the promos and still haven't seen the show, I think you're probably doing well. Some people love it, and good luck to you. If you're a maths tragic, then I get a laugh. No, I'm kidding. You do you, as Andrew would say. But in the meantime, I'm going to do me, and me does not include watching. Not that I ever watched Sons and Daughters either. I have to confess, Sale of the Century I still miss. Great show. 7 o'clock on a week on Channel 9.
Yeah.
Fantastic show. Lots of fun. Should we move on to actually the 20th century?
Yes. Yeah,
how long did you reckon Sale of the Century finished? Like 1992 or something?
Oh, gosh. It would have been a while ago, but yeah. That was sort of... I think that was a great education in of itself besides entertainment. It was a very much a family thing. You'd sort of all sit around and compete against. Oh, I loved it.
For a pick of the board, who am I? We're losing all of our listeners' references here. Who was the inaugural host? Do you remember?
Tony Barber.
Hold on. Yes, and the second one was Glenn. Glenn who?
Glenn. I was going to say Robbins. It's not Rob. I don't know. Who is it?
Close. Starts with R. Glenn Ridge.
Ridge. That's it.
Glenn Ridge. Glenn Ridge. And then, yes, plenty of co-hosts along the show. Anyway.
Back to 2024. Also, by the way,
exactly. Well, I have to, only because I just looked it up now. Do you remember the narrator's name? Because he'd finish with so-and-so speaking.
Oh, remind
give
me.
Give it away. Pete Smith.
Pete Smith, what a great voice.
Pete Smith speaking. It was, yeah, exactly. Anyway, back to 2024, as you say. Mate, let's... come to the podcast. I was going to say, come to the podcast. I won't do any 80s references. I can't promise that. There probably will be 80s references if you come to the podcast. Andrew Guaranteed. Will try and keep us in the 21st century. Mates, big news of the week, rates on hold. The RBA left rates at 4.35%. No one was surprised by that. Apparently, Reuters surveyed 40 economists, and every one of those 40 said rates would remain on hold. And surprise, surprise, they remained on hold. Interestingly enough, before the decision was made, there was an article on the Fin on Mondays from five prominent economists, including a couple that I, you know, could recognise by sight: Paul Bloxham from HSBC and Warren, lost it now. Anyway, who, you know, they said Hogan. They didn't expect the RBA to cut at all. Warren Hogan, thank you. Mm. They didn't expect the RBA to cut this year at all. And Shane Elliott from ANZ came out on Tuesday morning and said he thinks that's possible as well. The RBA didn't cut on Tuesday, nor did they raise, which is probably a good thing for anyone with a mortgage. But after the RBA said we're keeping rates on hold, the dollar went down and the stock market went up. And I thought it was worth talking a little bit about this because I had people say to me on Twitter, everyone expected it. What was the surprise? And the surprise was in the language in the statement. Now, the RBA puts out a statement. They say, we're doing this with rates. Here's what we're thinking. They put in minutes of the meeting, which are a more expanded version of it, out of normally in a couple of weeks' time, a couple of weeks after it happens. But this one was, and this is, I can never say whether this is good or bad, man. I know your view on the RBA and central banks in general, but I can never work out. I think I've said before, the journos mostly who want content want the RBA to have press conferences because somehow there's a sense of if the government's got to ask questions and it's more transparent and all that kind of stuff. Now, we know these days that any executive or public servant worth their salt is so incredibly media trained, they won't say anything they don't want to say anyway. It's not like all of a sudden you get to ask a question and they give you a straight answer and you get on with it. They know well enough what to say and what not to say and which questions to avoid and, you know, a smile and a nod and a laugh and move on to the next thing. They said that, as in previous months, that they want to. Inflation is important. They want to fix inflation. That's been the common theme. The difference in this one, and this is, it feels silly to say, except you have to believe that they know what they're saying, and they know the market's going to pay attention. So there is that kind of I nod, you wink, we're all okay. Not in a underhanded way. They took out the phrase at the end, which was something like quote, the board remains resolute and will do whatever is required to get inflation under control. Whatever that kind of. They left that out this time.
Yeah.
And it's the first time. Now, Governor Bullock's been in charge now for 6 months, maybe 5 months. So she's had plenty of chance to change that at any point during her tenure. The fact they changed it today, or this week, it was on Tuesday, seems to suggest that they're trying to soften us up for the rate cuts to come. That's certainly what the market took from it, because the dollar fell by 0.8%, and the stock market jumped by 0.4%. Not big moves, obviously, but directionally, given that, you know, everyone already knew or expected what would happen, there was no actual event decision to respond to. There seems to be a response to the language, and I have to think that that's the RBA being very deliberate to remove that, and the market taking that as a sign that the rate cuts are coming, and they're kind of softening the language, preparing us for the point at which they're going to cut rates.
Yeah. What a pantomime. You know, it's like, we're not going to say it directly, but we're going to kind of say it anyway. And I know that you know. You know, and it's sort of like, just say it.
Right.
And I thought the other thing that was interesting too is that Chanticleer put it well in the Fin Review. It's basically, it was a masterclass in saying 25 different ways that inflation has not been tamed, policy is restrictive, and the central bank is unsure when rates will move or which way they will move. And Bullock, a quote from her directly, what the board is basically saying is that we are uncertain. We don't know, and we can't rule anything in or out. And that's not to be critical. I actually think that's the most honest statement that they can
totally,
make.
And that's, I completely agree. And it's like companies giving guidance. It's like just and this is my criticism of the press conference. And frankly, of the statement is all the RBA has up its sleeve is surprise.
Mm-hmm.
Because once the market knows what the RBA expects, they quotes price that in. We've had people ask what that means.
It's the jawbone. It's the jawbone tool.
Right. If the RBA says we expect to cut rates 3 times this year, and the US Fed does it, I think even worse. They give their so-called dot plots where they kind of they all give forecasts about where they think rates will be at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. So the market goes, okay, good. Now we know that, we can price that in. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of like, well, then by the time you get there and make that decision, no one's surprised. The market's already priced that in. Mm-hmm. So you lose. The only time you have an impact on the market is when you do something that the market wasn't expecting.
Yep.
Whether
that something is the actual policy change itself or the change in the rhetoric.
Correct. And this is again, the latter is exactly what happened this time around, which was that exact idea of they're taking that away. They must mean something. You're right. I don't know. The jawbone is useful. So I guess on one hand, you don't want to take it away. You want them to be able to influence markets by having to use the blunt tool or the blunter tool of rates. Mm. On the other hand, to your point about the pantomime, like I don't know, again, I know you'll get rid of central banks. Assuming we retain central banks and they have rate setting powers, I don't know what else to do. My instinct is to say, just stop the whole communication thing. Just tell us what the rate is, when it is the rate, and get on with it. Now, the markets hate it because the markets want to be told so that they can put numbers in boxes, which is just its own, speaking of pantomime, I'm not sure the bigger pantomime is the markets, not the RBA, right? Which is,
right.
Well, if you don't tell me what to do, what can I think? Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of your job, not mine, right? If I'm the RBA, my job is not to spoon feed you people so you can put your forecast in and make millions of dollars trading currencies. Like, that's not my job. My job is to manage the economy. Via monetary policy, or part of the economy, or have managed to influence the economy through monetary policy. It's just, what would you do? Would you again, assuming you have to keep central banks, do you say stop communicating? Do you keep them communicating? Do they just say, we're taking this out because we think rate cuts might happen eventually, and so we're just getting you ready for it? I can't quite work out what I would do if I was in this situation.
Yeah, me either. I don't know if there is a solution. I mean, I guess what we would hope for is honest, frank, forthright communication, hand on heart. Exactly. What's your best guess?
Yeah.
Being cognizant.
Phil, I tried that. It didn't go well.
Well, this is the trouble, you know. But I guess also being cognizant that it is just a guess, right? An educated guess, if you will, but that's what it is. And I think that's where people get really angry, is they take these prognostications as fact. And there's nothing Machiavellian or sinister about it. It's just like, I mean, we all have expectations of the future that don't come to pass, or not in the way that we expect. Right. In fact, that's the default, right? Like, if we all had perfect clarity, you know, we're all great soothsayers, it'd be a very different world. Yeah. So it's just, you know, partly it's us in demanding more than what can be given. Mm. So, mm. I don't know if I would do
I would
do anything different. I mean, the reality is, maybe you could sort of say, look, we don't know. Here's our best guess. But if that doesn't happen, this is what would be the, probably we would go in this direction if this and if that, and give you a few sort of paths, and this is how we're thinking about it. For me, it really boils down to this. It's really simple. It's kind of like, do you want to keep fighting inflation, or do you want to worry about growth? And at the moment, as you've rightly said, and for a while now, inflation's been the concern, because the growth, at least, you know, in aggregate on most of the, you know, measures that we have of the economy, is kind of okay. But, you know, as we've spoken about previously, there are a lot of sort of signs that things are turning in certain areas and stuff. And I just think, when push comes to shove, when you have this devil's choice between, do we want higher inflation, or do we want to stop the economy from crashing, you will always choose the latter. Like, inflation is like, we will tolerate that before we take anything else. And it's kind of the same thing. It's so pernicious, but that it's kind of, you know, it's still a whack, a very real whack to you, but it's the one that will always lose out when that choice needs to be made. And so this is what, if you want to know what the RBA is going to do, you need to have a view on what the economy is going to do. If the economy continues to sort of just muddle ahead, then they will keep interest rates as high as they can to try and until the inflation figure comes down a little bit. If things start to tip over and we start to see progressively worse economic data, you can bet that the inflation targeting, you know, thing takes a back seat. And now we're another turtle deep. But so what's the economy going to do? And I know everyone's going to have an opinion on that, and none of us will be exactly right, and some of us will be broadly right through luck. And so, again, we come back to our usual, after all of this, you know, what is it? Well, prepare, don't predict, expect the unexpected. factor in what might be the worst case scenario and make sure that you can withstand that. That's kind of where you always, or where I always end up with this stuff.
I think, I completely agree. I'm trying to work out. So, yeah, you know, Lowe said famously, we don't think rates will go up till late 2024. Turns out that was wrong by about 2 years. That would have fit under your here's my best guess scenario. Mm. And he was absolutely crucified for it because we're idiots. And we kind of want to believe that somehow these people have supernatural powers and we should be able to take it to the bank. And he was wrong and therefore he should have to pay. Mm. And I think, so I'm kind of struggling. On one hand, because we have an imperfect democracy and electoral system, no treasurer wants to give an RBA governor unfettered cover. Because then it reflects on you. If Chalmers gets up and says, yeah, Lowe was wrong, but it was his best guess, lay off him, everyone makes mistakes, just deal with it, people, then it become the headline, the shock jocks become Chalmers doesn't care, you know, he's not prepared to call Phil Lowe to account, blah, blah, blah. I think I would, in a perfect world, I have Treasury say exactly that. Guys, this is the reality of economic thinking. He made his best guess. He got it wrong. We all do. We've got to suck it up and be mature about it. That is the honest answer, as you said.
Mm.
In absence of that, given the you know, the incentives, frankly, we've talked about incentives a lot, I have a suspicion I would just say we're not going to give you forecasts. Mm. In fact, I've said that, and then someone says again, the economists say, well, what are we supposed to do with our numbers? Well, that's a you problem, not a me problem, right? That's mm-hmm. not the RBA's issue.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the RBA is a little bit too captured by the financial markets, quite honestly.
Yep.
I think the perceived need to manage those markets and help those markets and help those, you know, it's like, you know, that's not the real economy, guys. Mm. If the master universe and their shiny suits want to go and, you know, make some bets, that's their issue, not your issue.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'd start there. Maybe move from that. In terms of this year, though, here's the other thing. This is the stupidity of exactly your point. I didn't watch this press conference because the last one was just too much. The last press conference, Michelle Bullock was asked, so you've got two rate cuts in your effect. So the RBA puts out a set of forecasts for the economy. We think unemployment's going to be here, inflation's going to be there. And to do that, they have to make an estimate of what they expect interest rates to do. And they have two rate cuts in that number for this year. So Michelle Bullock's been asked, okay, so you made a forecast. That's, no, it's not a forecast. It's just what we think will happen. So and again, this is the problem is, obviously it's rubbish, right? I was going to say BS, but I won't. Obviously it's rubbish. But again, in the context of Phil Lowe's comment, if you're Michelle Bullock, that's exactly what you're going to say, because mm-hmm. you're not going to point the gun at your own head and say, actually, yeah, hold me accountable. But she's also right. If you make a forecast about an economy and you say, in 12 months' time, here's where we think things will be, you have to have included interest rates in that decision-making. Mm-hmm. If you think rates are going to go up 14 times from now and then, you're not going to say the economy's going to grow at 3.5%. You have to have said, here are the big inputs. It's unemployment and it's economic activity and it's global growth and it's whatever else. And so you roll all that together and you come up with a number. And you must include interest rates in that. So she has, and they've done that, as they should. But then it's like, well, no, it's not a forecast, not a promise. It's not a prediction. We're not saying it's going to happen. We're just saying this is what we think will probably happen. It's like, firstly, that's just stupid, you know, it's hair splitting. On the other hand, I don't blame her, given what happened to Phil Lowe. He effectively got turfed by Chalmers for being the bad guy to get some political pressure off the government. And so you're right. You know, you say we've got two cuts in the numbers, but we're not forecasting that. And it just kind of gets a bit silly at that point, surely.
Yeah. I mean, you know my view on it. I think it's all a bit of a nonsense, frankly. I mean, it's just that we are. You remove the theater from it all, and let's say that the, you know, we saw what happened to the previous governor, and let's say this one doesn't work out. It's a distraction. I mean, the system is the system is the system. It doesn't really matter. You can put anyone there, right? They're all cut from the same mold. I've made this point before.
That's right.
Bullock and Lowe have the exact same backgrounds and career paths. You know, and it's just sort of, and it's like a lot of things. It's like politics in general, right? You focus on the person, not the substance of the policy. You know, it's sort of like we'll talk endlessly about Boris Johnson's hair and Trump's hair and stuff, but not really You know, and I feel as though...
Is it the same hair, for the record?
Yeah, pretty much.
I'm not sure it's different hair. Go.
You can switch the actors and characters around, but there's more of fun, which is why we always sort of dovetail into that conversation, because it does get philosophical. And I would argue it kind of needs to be philosophical. We're not talking about the Newtonian laws of motion that are like, you know, laws of the universe here. The structure of the system and the philosophy and ideology that it rests on is a human construct. And there are different ways of doing things. And I'm not saying that, you know, that there needs to be a radical overhaul to any degree, but when the current apparatus of monetary policy is set up the way it is and grounded in the way it is, it is always going to act in the same kind of way. And we've had decades now of seeing how it does act. And it lurches to reacting too slowly, overreacting, winding it back, trying to guess what we're going to do. And I think at a more fundamental level, and again, I don't want to get into the conversation again, but you sort of step back and go, wait a second, it's really weird in these open and free markets how we have a centrally planned money. It just seems... at odds. It seems very disconnected. And so I would argue, and I've made this point before too, that all of the problems a large degree of the problems that we are dealing with now in 2024 stem from COVID. A lot of problems were percolating under the hood there, which stemmed from sovereign European debt crisis, which stemmed from the GFC, which you can trace some origins back to the tech bubble, you know, and it's sort of like we have this apparatus set up to try and manage things. But I think this is where the ideology sort of, we sort of split. It's just sort of like, I feel as though it's, you're trying to manage that, which cannot be that, not as managed as effectively as you feel as though you can. You know, you're a little boat bobbing in this great ocean here, and you can sort of hoist that sail and do this and that. But at the end of the day, there are far bigger forces at work. And I think it all stems from a good place. Hey, we don't want people to suffer. We want to make sure that we fix these things here. But what we end up creating is bigger problems. There's unintended consequences with all of that. So I don't know what we're doing. But for your point, which is always a good one, which is, but for better or worse, this is where it is. We know that there is incredible inertia with institutional thinking, and we're stuck for it for decades more to come. And I suspect you got to recognize the world as it is, not as you would have it. And I think that's a very good point. And making, so, you know, sort of getting out of the armchair and just sort of navel gazing and discussing it. I think where I sit is we continue to have this undercurrent of inflation, which remains higher for longer. Again, not the 7-8% that we got to, but 2-3% is, I just think it's a long way away. And trying to balance that with how much we want to stimulate the economy. And that will always be the discussion. It'll always come back to that. So again, if you want to just go down a few layers and think, what am I really looking at here? Again, you have to have a view on what the broader economy is going to do. And that's a diabolically tough question. And so again, this is why I think we would describe ourselves, at least, and to each their own, but as more bottom-up investors as opposed to top-down investors. Yep. The top-down investor being the person who looks at the macro, you know, landscape and goes, well, I think the economy is heading in this direction. Ergo, these are the kind of companies I want exposure to.
The bottom up, we will, or the companies with these component parts. Yeah, go on.
Yeah, because of these bigger macro tailwinds or headwinds, if you're going the other direction. But a bottom up investor, and I think we've both landed on this. And look, again, each their own. I think most investors, after a while, go this direction, which is that recognition of, like, I don't know. But I do know that whether the economic seas are rough or smooth, I want a really great quality company, you know? And I know that if I have that my capital will be reasonably well preserved over the long term and have some really nice periods of growth along the way. And that's kind of it, right? And it's wonderfully liberating as an investor. And I speak, particularly when you're new to this and you think, gosh, I've got to get my head around sort of income statements and balance sheets and business models and, you know, forecast what the company, and then I've got to put that into a wider macro landscape. And we spend an inordinate amount of time on this show talking about the macro because it is endlessly fascinating, but it is a wonderful forgive yourself is what I'm saying to investors. If you don't want, if you want to de-emphasize that stuff, not to ignore it completely, certainly have a view on it and all that kind of stuff, but don't let that, don't put the cart before the horse and don't let that lead your thinking. If all of this stuff is, guys, you're just saying one thing and then the other, and I'm still more confused than I ever was. Like, well, I'm yeah. Welcome to the club. Welcome to the party, exactly. Right? This is the reality of it. But don't feel as though you have to have a firm view. And if we're flippant and dismissive a lot of these things, it's not because we don't care or we don't think it's not important. It's just we recognize that it's going to be really hard to predict. But in any case,
you can't know. And exactly.
My investment strategy is not going to radically change anyway.
I'm gonna add a bit to that, man, actually, because looking backwards, you're absolutely right about now. Buffett had said, 4 or 5 years ago now, if interest rates remain this low, stocks are cheap.
Yes.
And that was the only time I can recall myself. So you're right, I'm absolutely a fundamental or a bottom-up investor. I look at the businesses themselves. But it's the only time I can recall thinking, even for a bottom-up investor, The so-called emergency level of rates mattered because it was always going to impact share prices and cost of debt and that kind of stuff in a way that we've never needed to bother before. Before 2019, or before 2020 effectively, I would have absolutely thought, bottom-up investor, don't care about rates, don't care about the macro, it doesn't matter. Over time, it won't matter. And I'm still pretty sure now, 5 years later, we still make that same statement. But it's also true that if you look at the huge, huge movements in share prices over that period of time in both directions and sometimes at the same time, or it's not the same company, you know, up and down and up and down again, a lot of that was you had to at least have a view on the likelihood of rates staying that low. And I'm pretty sure we said many times that it was really unlikely that rates would stay that low. But there were plenty of people saying, well, this is the new normal and rates won't go up again. And, you had to believe at least that things were going to go back to the old normal. Mm. You know, this is not a new normal. This is the old normal. We just had a new normal in between for a while or a new abnormal for a while. That was kind of the approach. And so I've never ever made an investment based on top-down thinking. But in terms of valuations in particular, there was some, you know, for a decent period through there, share price of a lot of companies were higher than they would have otherwise been because of that reality.
It's a great point.
I'll say again, you know, I will mention Kogan again, I'll have another drink. Kogan got to $25 at some point. Now, I, at that point, still retained a buy recommendation. I held my shares. In hindsight, was that stupid? I think so, probably. Yeah, I think I made a big mistake. And it was partly the market getting overexcited about that stuff. And I'm not sure Kogan can't justify a $20 share price at some point in the future. I still own the shares. I still think that they go higher from here. I think they're market beating from here for what it's worth, not as a plug, but just to kind of explain why I still own them. But they're at, you know, $8 or whatever it is now, not 20 or 25. So, you know, in hindsight, should I have sold? Yeah, because the market got carried away. And at that point, did I need a view on the macro? Maybe not necessarily. Maybe I still could have looked at a fundamental basis and said, if and when rates normalize, then this would happen. But you had to kind of believe that rates would normalize. And I think that's the only time in my investing career, I've been doing it for decades, where I really had to think about the role of interest rates for the first time in forever. Because Buffett said, or Lynch has said, somebody, you know, if you spend 15 minutes thinking about the economy, you've wasted 10 minutes. That's absolutely right. With the exception that even Buffett himself said, well, if rates stay at this level, you know, there was a very clear macro implication that you had to at least reckon with, I think, for a while. Now, that said, I'm just using that to highlight the past because we are now, I believe, back in the old normal. And so we can go back to almost directly ignoring the market, at least in terms of valuations, at least in terms of the impact on companies, and go back to thinking about, okay, what happens next? The other thing we need to think about, mate, I'm just going to throw back in quickly, is cycles. Cycles matter, cycles happen, cycles are a thing. And I say that only because we are going through economic cycles now. We haven't had a proper economic cycle for 35 years. Yes, we had a recession in the early 90s. Yes, we officially had a COVID recession, but it was weird. Just remember there are cycles. So yes, be bottom up. This is not, by the way, at odds with what Andrew said at all, or my own views. Be bottom up, but also be bottom up knowing that cycles happen, and focus on what I've called, I'm no genius, that's not a new phrase for me, but underlying earnings power. That is the key three-word phrase for me. Yep. If you're going to do any valuation work at all, ever, underlying earnings power is all that matters. In other words, if it's unusually low, then, you know, unless there's reason to believe it's permanently lower for some reason, look at the underlying earnings power. In other words, when things normalize, what does that look like? If profits are unusually high because I know maybe you're a, you know, your online retailer in during COVID. Again, is that really a new normal, or is that just unusual? In which case, commodity companies are a great example of this. The iron ore price through the roof or through the floor. Neither is likely to be a continuous and ongoing state. So just be always careful to think about the business's basic underlying fundamentals. And again, to your point, Ram, that's why we go with bottom up, because we say, right, what does this company do? Is it going to be around, which is your favorite first question, which I love. Yeah. Is it going to be bigger or smaller than this in the future? What is some sort of ongoing, maybe an average or a, you know, underlying, whatever phrase, whatever framework you want to use? You want to work out what is the kind of the reliable level of ongoing profitability on average over your holding period, and use that for your valuation. That's why bottom up is so important, because same with top down of, you know, will the economy be higher or lower? I don't know. Okay, will the dollar be higher or lower? I don't know. What about the gold price? I don't know. Is it good for retail? I don't know. I think about the number of combinations of guesses and assumptions you have to get right as you go through that, versus saying, this is a decent, interesting company. So people seem to like it. They're using it in, you know, greater numbers over time. Is it going to keep being the case? Well, probably. Okay. Is it, are earnings likely to grow on that basis? Yeah, probably. Okay. That's so much easier. Frankly, I think it's probably more accurate too, mate, and hopefully more profitable than trying to make these big crystal ball prognostications about the future.
Yeah. So, yes, you've said a lot there.
Sorry.
No, you're right to emphasize that. That period of ultra-low interest rates really wrong-footed a lot of traditional value investors, where they looked at things as too expensive. And maybe they were right, but they just missed out on incredible gains, right? And then there were other period, examples of, well, no, this is the new normal, and then it wasn't. So you're right to point out that, yeah, it matters. But what I would say is that the reason why you can be more flippant about it, or the only scenario in which you can be flippant about it, is if you do have that long-term lens, which is why you kind of, I think you're forced. If you're going to invest, you're kind of forced to be a long-term investor.
You may try anything else.
You can normalize those things. So what's, I don't know, use your example. What's interest rates going to be? Just go with the average of what's been over the last 30. I mean, I don't know. That's probably not going to be right, but it's going to be better than trying to predict something at the fringe. The other point I would say is that when you have a very good quality company and you overpay, you will underperform and it'll be disappointing. Yep. But it's not going to be a disaster. An example that came to mind for me was CSL, which I think everyone listening will have heard of. It's one of the great Aussie success stories, created incredible shareholder wealth over the years. But back in early 2020, I mean, that thing was through there. It was nearly $340 a share, right? It's $280 now. But when you sort of look at the chart between 2020 and 2024, it's kind of the big sideways channel. So it's kind of like, the point I'm making is not dismiss all of that stuff, but even if you get it wrong on valuation with a high quality company, you're still okay, right? Now, contrast that with, I don't know, something like Dubber, for example, which many people may not have heard of. They do software that sort of does call recordings and that kind of stuff. They had incredible sales growth for years and years and years and years, but just never came to any profitability. Share price went to the moon, you know, but then, you know, just they're having troubles now, right? And there was those underlying
Appen's
cash flows. Appen, right?
Yeah.
Another great example as well. So my point being is, what were the dominant factors that wrote the fortunes of the investors in those companies? Was it the macro landscape? Well, the macro landscape impacted both of them in both extremes, but it was ultimately the fundamentals that did it. And the other thing I'll say is you reminded me there with, when trying to sort of forecast, you know, like you might want to think, well, what's an average PE of the market likely to be in 5 years' time? There was this study, I'm going to get the details wrong, but it was basically looking at the accuracy of building quotes. And so there was two schools of thought. There was this sort of the younger generation. Have I still got you there? I might keep going. You may have dropped out. There was the younger generation that would add up all of the various components. Okay, I need this much cement. I'm going to add that up. There's a margin on that. I'm going to put in the timber here. Then there's labor. I'm probably going to need this people. And they go through this ostensibly fairly scientific, rigorous process in coming up with a quote. But it was always off. It was always off. As we always know, like these, you know, everything runs over cost. The more experienced builders did it in this fashion. And the way that they would do it was, they would just basically say, how many square meters is it? what's the overall quality of the build? I'm going to multiply those two numbers together. And it gives you this, mm-hmm. it turns out to be fairly accurate. And then, you know, I think there was something like, oh, I always add 20% myself to it. You just because I know that there's going to be that cost overrun. So it's analogous to business forecasting. The more granular you get, it feels more specific.
That's right.
But for these kinds of things, the rules of thumb tend to be far more accurate. I mean, in both cases, specifically, you're going to be probably wrong. But if you just got to go with, and I've talked about that with evaluating a company before, like thumb suck what the earnings per share is going to be in 5 years, thumb suck a PE, multiply the two together, you've got a target price for out there. You know, it's a nice, elegant, easy way. And it's sort of, it's frowned upon by a lot of people because it is overly simplistic. And you're not going to know what the PE is any more than you know what the price is going to be in 5 years' time. That's cool because I'm not trying to, I'm really just sort of saying what is a reasonable kind of number. And rather than trying to anticipate that it's going to be at a high end of the range or be, have my investment returns predicated and reliant on a specific number, it's kind of like, if I just go with the average, I'm probably going to be wrong, but I'm not going to be far off. I hope all of that makes sense.
No, it does. I think that's roughly right rather than precisely wrong, mate. The idea of,
that's it.
You know, the human need... I said so many times, mate, you know, investing is successfully reigning in our biology. That's literally the definition, is being able to say, well, my brain instinctively wants this, and knowing that it can't happen, and so how to manage accordingly is actually the answer. It's why Buffett has been so incredibly successful, because he said, I know people want me to do stuff. I feel like I want to do stuff. I'm going to go and sit myself in a corner in the middle of the Midwest of the US, get away from Wall Street, get off New York, because, you know, everyone's trying to make me do something or tell me to do something. I'm going to sit and think and do my thing. And that is not instinctive for most humans. We're not very good at it. So you're right, making sure you can kind of say, well, roughly what does this look like, and am I going to be roughly right more often than not? The deep desire for, if I just had a bit of software, if I could just do another couple of equations, if I could just chart this differently, if I just had more data. And you're right, we've talked before about the behavioral psychology thing of, you know, the research that was done where you give people 5 bits of data, you're asking to make a prediction, and then give you a level of confidence. You give them another 20 bits of data and do the same thing, their predictions are no more accurate, but their confidence goes through the roof.
Yep.
And it's just got more stuff. And so we just are so inclined to think, if only I had more information, I could make a better call. I really honestly think, mate, the longer you and I have been doing this, certainly for me, I imagine for you too, the more I strip away that stuff. You know, you can get to a pretty good... Yeah, I mean, you've got to have done it for a while, because a lot of this is heuristics and things you learn on the way. So I'm not saying you could, you know, be an 18-year-old leaving school and all of a sudden spend 5 minutes and pick good stocks. But that idea of just like, you know, how likely is this to keep going? You mentioned some of the tech companies. You mentioned what drove them. The answer is actually just sentiment, fundamentally. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, we talk about rates. Why was that? Well, because rates are cheap. Money was free. Anyone could get money. And so people were prepared to bet that if you throw enough money at this thing, eventually they'd make it work. And I'm going to say, so to be really fair to those people, it may have been true.
Yeah.
The thing was, the money being thrown was never going to be thrown forever. Mm-hmm. And so there was always a race against time, whether they acknowledged it at the time, whether they knew it at the time or not. It's musical chairs. You've only got a chair until the music stops, and then we're all scrambling for a chair. And if you're in the business of, I'll worry about the chair later, I'm just going to try and grow my business, and hopefully when the music stops, I'll have a chair. Mm-hmm. That was always a dangerous game. And again, I'll remind our listeners, it will happen again. It's happened before. It was the dot-com boom. Mm-hmm. Effectively, I think tech didn't crash quite the same way in 2022, was it, or 23, as it did during the tech crash or the dot-com crash. But frankly, not far off. If you look at some of the companies, not the whole sector, obviously the NASDAQ fell 80% during the dot-com crash. So this was blood on the streets across the board. Mm. But if you exclude, I don't know, the top half dozen companies, technology one, zero, a couple of others, and then you look at the combination of the Afterpays, Dubbers, Appens, the sexy hot stocks of, you know, 2018, 19, 22, and 22, a lot of those, you know, did they have decent models? Yeah. Was it possible they could be successful? Yeah. But a lot had to go right, and I think people tend to suspend disbelief when money's free and you can keep throwing money at it. That's where, again, back to the macro thing, that's why I think it was worth thinking about the macro of what has to happen for this to continue.
Yeah.
And is it likely? And I think it wasn't... we'll move on in a sec. The service I run, Motley Fool Share Advisors, is not an ad for Share Advisor at all. What I will say is, during the go-go years, Share Advisor underperformed. You know, we didn't recommend Dubber or Appen or any of that stuff, and we look like deals. There were people getting 40% annual returns, you know, buying that sort of stuff because that was going to be the next big thing. And I'm sitting there going, well, I don't know, but I'll just keep buying the stuff that seems to make sense. Now, I'm happy to say subsequently, we're sitting here in March 2024, we're beating the market soundly, the recovery's been good. And as those things crashed, we kind of kept going through too. And it's not the only way to invest. It's not even the right way to invest. I'm just saying, you know, there will be times when you can feel like you are missing out. The grass is greener, everyone else is making money. They're having fun at the party and you're sitting at home going, oh, this is miserable. I'm doing okay. Or maybe I'm even going backwards. I mean, this was Buffett in 99. Mm-hmm. I think Berkshire lost 25% while the NASDAQ was up 80% or something ridiculous in that year. And you kind of go, man, how is that, you know, how is that possible? And it was just because people said, well, Buffett's boring. I want the exciting stuff.
Yep.
And then the exciting stuff went badly. People went, oh, they're Buffett. Like, he knows a few things. Now, I'm not, I don't for a second want to compare myself to Buffett. My point is, boring investing can seem boring and even cost you money or seem to cost you money when everyone else is getting overexcited. But to your point about the fundamentals, if you get that bit right. And by the way, there were some great little tech companies with great fundamentals that still haven't come back. So I'm not for a second saying that they're all bad businesses. What I'm saying is the sentiment that drove them can go away as quickly as it comes. What matters in the long term, and this point you've been making, is it's the fundamental value of the businesses. Either they're going to be profitable or not. They're going to get bigger or they're not. That's what drives the long-term returns. In the meantime, it's just an opinion contest. It's just a beauty contest.
Mm. Have I done the walking the dog analogy recently?
Not recently. Do it again because I like it a lot.
Let's trot it out. It's not mine. It's from a US fund manager, and I've gone blank on the name, but he said, I'll localize it. Imagine there's a man with a dog on a leash. It's a very long leash and the dog's very excited. It's a Kelpie or something like that. And he's starting at Central Station. He's walking to Circular Quay and he's walking at 6 kilometers an hour just as he makes his way down sort of George Street. The dog though is obviously going to be distracted along the way. He's going to see, you know, a pole that it can mark its territory on. It's going to see a poodle walking by. It's going to, you know, chase a rat. You know, it's just going to, if you watch that dog, it is going to go in all kinds of directions and you're never going to be able to predict what is the next thing that's going to catch its eye. Or, you know, someone dropped a sausage on the street and it's going to dart off that way. But he is tethered to the man and the man is walking at 6 kilometers an hour from Central to Circular Quay. So what most market participants do is they watch the dog. And they try and predict where the dog is going based on where the dog has been recently. So it darted left. And it's like, okay, it's probably going to keep going in that direction. Oh, it's running backwards. Okay, it's going to keep going in that direction. The more fundamental oriented investor just goes, no, I'm going to watch the man. And the man is moving in that direction. Now, the obvious metaphor here is that the man is the company and the dog is the share price. Uh-huh. And it's such a nice, neat little one because it really describes it very well. And sometimes that mangy mutt will be just so crazy. You know, the dream will be running ahead, like super keen to get to the desk. Otherwise, it's like, nah, it's just dragging its bum as you have to drag it on the leash. And it's really diabolically hard. But again, once you see that's what's sort of going on here, it's actually, as I always say, it's a wonderful thing. It sucks to kind of go through it, but it's only with the benefit of hindsight you recognize that those challenging periods when everyone is seemingly buying Ferraris and, you know, flying business class all around the world, you think, what am I doing wrong? Or, everything I've bought's not gone well. But it's like, well, just bear in mind if you put your money on, someone who's walking in a fairly straight line in a fairly obvious direction to a fairly obvious destination, bet on that person, right? And forget what their pet is doing.
And by the way, the reverse is also true. If the bloke holding the lead is a maniac who is, you know, I don't want to, some down and out drunk who's a ne'er-do-well criminal. I don't want to be serious. You know what I'm saying? Even though the dog's running ahead of a million miles an hour, it can disguise. So, you know, the volatile dog can disguise a very good, sustainable, long-term business, which you've just described. Mm-hmm. It can also mask a rubbish business that looks better because everyone's excited about it. And when that excitement happens, you are tempted to look at the dog.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
I tweeted during the week, as my first tweet reference for the podcast, the Tesla share price. Now, Tesla over the, I wasn't going to go here, but it's a good opportunity. This is not about Tesla at all, by the way. That's happening looking up the share price for God knows what reason. And I looked at it over a five-year chart. And people say, oh, how is Tesla going? Or how is Company X going? It doesn't matter what company it is. And you say, oh, it's the company's going well, the company's going bad. That's a great investment, it's a terrible investment. Those things, when people talk about those things, tend not to actually be about the company itself. It tends to be about the share price. Mm. Now, that's reasonable. At the end of the day, we only get the return from the share price. We don't get the return of the company in and of itself. But here's what I tweeted. I said, it's important you understand the base effect when people talk about performance. Here's a great example. I said, I was a couple of weeks ago, actually. Tesla is up 830% over 5 years. Okay, so keep that in mind. 830% over 5 years. It's also flat over the past 3 1/3 years, and it's down 57% over the past 2 years and 4 months. So is Tesla a great stock or not?
It's all of those things. It's all of those things.
Exactly. Exactly. It's not, exactly. And none of them. Yeah. Because unless you bought them on those, and I picked highs and lows deliberately because I wanted to make that point. It's been all over the place. Now, is Tesla a great stock? Well, if you bought it at its high, you've lost 2/3 of your money almost. Mm-hmm. And you're kicking the dog. If you bought it 5 years ago, you've almost 10 extra money and you think you're a genius. Now, are you a genius? Probably not. Are you an idiot if you bought it two years and 4 months ago because it's down 6%? No. But the reality is that you've got to separate the company, your point, the man, from the dog.
Yep.
Is Tesla a great stock? It's actually the wrong question to ask. Mm-hmm. In fact, looking backwards is the wrong way to do it altogether.
Yep.
What you're really asking yourself is, from today's price, is Tesla likely to be a good investment? That's the entire question.
Yep.
The past is irrelevant. The base effect is irrelevant. The other thing, by the way, if Tesla share price went nowhere, the one-year chart, the one-year return, would fluctuate all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Because a year ago, it was down. 6 months ago, it was up. So if the price goes nowhere, it's going to go from this terrible underperforming stock to all of a sudden this market-beating stock, even if the price doesn't move. Because the year-ago price you're comparing to is all over the place. And that's why it's such a silly idea to use charts. It's such a silly idea to try and look at the past or even 1 year highs, 1 year lows, all that kind of stuff. All it tells you is what the market thinks now, what the market used to think. It tells you absolutely nothing about the business itself.
Yep. Well said.
Have we done that to death?
Yeah, I think so.
Mate, can we go to, we were talking about macro before and I kind of want to go back there a little bit, only because it's a hobby horse of mine, frankly. So maybe I'm overly focused on it. That's fair enough. Maybe, or maybe it's not. Michelle Bullock was asked about inflation and population growth at the press conference on Tuesday. And she said that inflation had been boosted by the levels of immigration and population growth. At the same time, we heard during the week that housing supply is likely to hit decade lows and stay there right through until 2026. At the end of 26, by the way, so 2.5 years away. Why do we know that? Because we know what the housing approvals have been. We know what the commencements look like based on those approvals, and we know how long it takes to get to completion. So we have this, effective, not exactly a crystal ball, but if the housing hasn't been approved, it hasn't been started, it's not going to be finished. We know that much.
Yeah.
Short of dropping shipping containers, having people live in them, we kind of know what this looks like. We can kind of see 2026, mate. And I think, Michelle Bullock kind of said the quiet bit out loud, at least, on the behalf of the government, which is for a government that says we are doing everything we can to deal with the cost of living, and for all of the fact the cost of living is a cliche and all that kind of stuff these days, when you say we're doing all we can, and yet you've got, population growth that exceeds current dwelling growth, let alone future dwelling growth over the next 18 months, when you have, pressure on both food, electricity, energy, general prices, and housing prices. I don't know. I don't know whether I have a point other than sharing my ongoing frustration that regardless of what you think about how big Australia could be in 10, 20, 30, 50 years, the simple reality now is we are, my 11-year-old could do the maths and tell you this is not sustainable. And I don't actually know how this finishes. I don't frankly know what to do with the information. It seems like for all of the obvious maths the rest of us can do on the back of an envelope, the government simply chooses to ignore it for reasons of their own national interest or self-interest, and you can have your own view. The opposition kind of raised a little bit and then kind of shrunk back from the question. The government's announced more housing target of 1.2 million homes, which is just not going to happen. They've announced a review of immigration levels, which is maybe going to happen at some point, potentially between now and whenever those things eventually happen. I find it really frustrating, mate, because I feel like for all of our conversation we've had lots of times about the financialization of housing, about the issues around taxing of housing, all that kind of stuff, it just seems that, you know, we can, you and I can disagree, or we can agree but disagree with others about ideology and philosophy and politics, and, you know, the priority you put on certain things, the policies we'd all put in place would be slightly different. You'd have Bitcoin as a national currency. you know, the for all of that, this is just math, isn't it? I don't know. I feel like I'm shouting at clouds, but I feel like I'm in this alternate universe where the answer seems really, 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 really clear without any ambiguity or argument. And yet it's almost like, are we living in the same world as them? What's going on?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, there's a couple parts to that. The first one is, well, what do you do? Well, you slow the rate of immigration, right? Because the supply side of things is going to be much harder and much slower to kind of move. But, you know, every action has an opposite reaction in economics usually. And the thing that they're mindful of there is that, well, actually, you take away the population growth, you take away the GDP growth. And we've talked about before, we're actually in recession and no government wants that. So there's that. There's also, you talk about the financialization of housing. I think and I've long talked about affordability constraints, and we're getting, I mean, I've said many times, and we'll say it again, that the cure for high prices is high prices, right? And we know that there's a huge demand for housing. We know that developers like to make money, and we know that the government, you know, at least in, you know, rhetorically is aligned and behind sort of alleviating that supply constraint. So why isn't it happening? Is it purely a planning issue? I think that plays a big part in it. I think we should cut a lot of red tape and keep all the appropriate stuff. But I also think my broader point here is that I don't think the margins are there for the developers. In other words, it's like all of our building materials cost this. Right? And so... So look at this as a bit, well, it is a business. Look at it like a business, right? I'm a developer. Well, if I build some houses and some units, there's no trouble that, you know, there'll be people who will want them, at least at a certain price if they can afford them. So I add up all my costs, my building materials, the land, the workers, all of that kind of stuff. And it comes, and I'm not a charity, right? Nor should they be. So I want to make a margin to make it worth my while to even bother taking all this risk and doing it, right? Like it's, everyone does that. And so they do it all and they go, okay, so we'll have a house and if we sell it for $3 million, it'll be worthwhile. But you're at the point now, it's like most people can't afford that, right? So you're butting up against, it's an immovable object meets an unstoppable force in a lot of ways here. It's sort of like we just don't have the economic incentive. Even if you cleared the decks and the government said, right, you can build wherever you like and you can do this and whatever. And, you know, as long as there's some kind of IDA building standards or whatever, it's like, I don't know how you solve it. And it comes back to really, you know, one of the other solutions is for prices to go down or nowhere for a long time. That's, we always come back to that point. And again, it's not, everyone must feel as like I'm gunning for that. I'm not gunning for it, I can assure you.
No, I think we should be. I think we should be. I think you're right. Every politician who talks about affordability then throws more fuel on the fire. Affordability, either wages go up or prices come down. They are the only two things, or both if you want to, they're the only two things that make things more affordable. Everything else just kicks the can down the road under the guise of affordability. And I'm going to say it's politically effective because people are so desperately, you know, kind of desperate. They are prepared to say, well, at least it's something. Is it this bloody, the LNP, we talked about this last week, the 50 grand super. You know, people say, well, at least it's something. And I was kind of like, no, you don't get it. This is worse than nothing. Mm-hmm. But it's still for people who want to believe, who need to believe, because I think, well, I can't do it any other way. So this must be worth a go. I'm like, no. It's possible that, you know, any potential solution that's not this is not, nothing, you know, not everything is better just because it's different. Yep. But I get why people say, well, at least give it a go because I'm not going to be able to do it this way. My issue, mate, about the cure for high prices, I mean, you're absolutely right. The difference is, to my mind, this is not a closed system because we keep bringing more people into the country at unsustainable rates. So you're not letting that happen. I think the cost of the land, the ability to expand, the distances away, like there are some really significant changes that are problematic, even on top of building costs, which are just the land costs and the available land. Vacancy is now 0.7% in Australia. I thought about it 0.9. I mean, under one is stupidly low anyway. I don't know how this gets resolved. As you said, you're 100% right that the cure for high prices are high prices. The problem is, I suppose, it's not a closed system, right? You've got people able to leave and arrive. And while ever Australia is better than where they've come from, for whatever reason, whether it's meeting up with family or socioeconomic improvements or avoiding wars and conflicts or claims for asylum, however they come, I don't blame anyone for wanting to come to Australia and say it's better over there. I don't care about the average Australian's affordability problems because it's a hell of a lot better than my problems I had in my home country. I don't blame anyone for wanting to come here. But when you're in that situation, it is causing this ongoing imbalance. I think that until we resolve, get that sort of back to some degree of parity, I don't know if it's enough outside that closed system for high prices to be the cure for high prices in and of themselves, given the various motivations at work.
I mean, that is the X factor, isn't it? I do question the narrative a little bit, and I need to dig into the data myself to have the answer. But my anecdotal observation is that of all the people coming to live to Australia, there's not a huge percentage that are, cranial surgeons and investment bankers. And, there's a lot of students in that. There's fruit pickers. They're not the kind of people who are buying up $10 million properties, right?
So, 100%.
Now, there is definitely a factor that is there, and I'm sure there is a flight of capital.
It's just all incremental. That's the...
I think we all know it's a facto, as some people overemphasize it and gets xenophobic. Correct. Very quickly, but there is absolutely a flight of capital from China, right? And Vietnam and other places and that is definitely a factor, right? But we were talking at the start of the pod of trying to sort of predict things and what do you want to sort of have everything predicated on? So you're right. Yeah. Like that, it could go crazier for a lot longer if that access to fresh and significant capital is open. But it kind of feels like, short of that and just ongoing government stimulus, can you really expect these things to grow or to double every 7 years? I don't think that they can. So you're back to the affordability issue. Just the math comes down to it. And again, I always get into this, the debate can get lost over specifics. And where I like to come back to is, I don't want to have a question as like, it's at this level where it breaks. Like, I don't know where that level is, right?
Exactly.
I don't know. But logically, I know that if you just extend the line, extrapolate all of the things that are in place now, it gets to a point where it's crazy. And you might think it's $10 billion for a two-bedroom unit before it gets crazy. I might think it's much less than that. But the point is, it gets crazy at a point. And it's only a question of where that kind of is, because the path is unsustainable. It just is. And that's just math. Unless you disregard the laws of mathematics, that's just fact. And so...
And you can't disregard the laws of math. So even more fundamental, your point about high prices cure high prices, which is 100% right, is 1 + 1 = 2. It just does. That's why I find it, this particular issue for... And again, you and I disagree on the long-term stuff. And that, again, people can absolutely, ideologically and philosophically, have different views on that. That's completely fine. I'm good with that. And whether we have different views or not, I'm probably wrong, you're probably right. When the maths are just the maths, there's X number of houses, there's Y number of households, there's Y families effectively. And if Y is bigger than X, then people haven't got anywhere to live. Honestly, mate, I find this so stupidly frustrating. I get frustrated by people who I don't agree with or who seem to have a different view to me. I think that view is wrong. But when the math is just, when you literally do one minus the other is whatever, it's just, if the number at the end is not positive, then there's not enough houses. It's that simple, surely.
Yep, it's really what it is. And again, the danger is to get stuck on specific mathematical assumptions, but the general sort of trajectories of these things, I'll guarantee you this. I don't know in what way, shape, or form, but the problem will resolve itself. One way or the other, slowly, fast, painfully, not too painfully. It will. I mean, I've referenced it before, but Aaron Kohler wrote a great piece recently. He was just basically saying the best case scenario for everyone here is just a very long extended period of sideways prices for houses. That's kind of what we should hope for. because, and I know people who have houses now will be like, no, I want it to keep going up. But then there's the second and third order effects of all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, so it's just sort of, yeah, I don't know. I feel like we're covering old ground again.
Yeah, we are. Mate, let's finish off with, speaking of old ground, I find the work from home, work from the office, flexible working thing, not as clear cut as the population versus housing, because that's just maths. But there's AGL have come out this week and said people must return to work 3 days a week in the office. Otherwise, it'll impact their performance reviews and their bonuses. And so let me say up front, as long as it's legal, a company can mandate its employees to do whatever it wants to do because they're employed by the company. The company's paying the bills. And, you know, again, as long as it's legal, that's completely reasonable. I have no issue with AGL. I have no issue with the legality or the appropriateness of AGL mandating where and how its staff work.
Mm-hmm.
I find, though, the mandate, frankly, stupid. And I'd be interested in your thoughts. Now, I work from home, you work from home. Maybe we're not exactly representative. I think once you, if you're mandating it, what you're really saying is people wouldn't do it unless we made them. So that's the first thing, right? So people don't want to do this.
Mm.
And AGL's saying, well, hang on, if you want a bonus, if you want, effectively, here's the stick, right? You're not getting your bonus, you're going to be marked down your performance review unless you turn up. If you are someone who works for AGL or a similar company, and you prefer the flexibility and you're product, genuinely productive, not just saying you are, because everyone can do that. If you're valuable to an employer, and you want to work from home, you're going to be motivated to find another employer who gives you more flexibility. Now, if you're a great employee and you want to stay, then you're probably in the office anyway. So AGL doesn't gain anything from that employee. The good one who wants to work from home more often, who says, well, actually, I'll go and leave and join Origin, or I'll join someone else, I'll change jobs, I'll change profession, I'll go do that. AGL loses that great employee. And by the way, the slacker at home is going to be a slacker in the office, because you and I have worked in offices before and we know full well if a boss thinks just by being at a cubicle makes you somehow more productive, that is a fantastic self-delusion, because you and I have both been there, mate. The long lunches, the coffees, the you know, the rumour mongering, the scrolling Facebook. The idea that somehow being in an office, the manager are omnipresent and can stop any shirking, but at home they can't. I find that fascinating in a bizarre way. And I just feel like, mate, I've said this before, if you gave me a basket of flexible work companies and a basket of mandate work from the office companies, I would happily buy the former and short the latter. It won't work for an individual company, but the brain drain, we talk about brain drains at a country level. If you can work from home and work from anybody, why wouldn't you? You're going to work for the one where you get to have what you want. And if you're a great employee, you're going to leave. I've worked for companies. I won't name them. I worked for a company that was, the morale and stuff was pretty bad for about 18 months. And what I've watched happen was all the good people went, this sucks, I'm going somewhere else. And the bad people went, this sucks, but I can't get a job anywhere else, so I guess I'll stay. Now think about what that does over time. The good people leave, the bad people stay. Multiply that over months and months and months and years. You have this massive, massive just down trading. The average just falls and falls and falls. And I will never understand why someone like an AGL or any other company thinks they can have a better result by mandating attendance, presence, not work, not output, just literal presence. And somehow in the 21st century, in 2024, despite my sons and daughters references at the beginning of the podcast, to believe that the only way you can manage someone and get decent outcome or output is by having them literally sitting at a cubicle. My mind is blown. And people on Twitter say, no, of course, Your Honor, the best people will already be in the office. Like, yeah, they will. So that's cool. Knock themselves out. Well, they'll be slacking at home. I'm like, they'll be slacking. I don't understand the one-dimensional thinking that says if they're sitting in a chair in an office with a company brand out the front, they're going to work harder and be more productive. I just find that. Am I completely mad? Am I going bananas? What's going on?
No, I mean, look, I class it also as a problem that will solve itself. You know, when there's always a tension between employers and employees. Obviously, the employers want to have the best employees at the lowest possible price. Employees want to do the least amount of work for the most amount of money. That's just rational, right? From both of their perspectives. And they're going to have to meet in the middle somewhere. And meeting in the middle will very heavily depend on the rate of pay. I mean, I will clean toilets all day long if you pay me $200,000 a year, right? Like there is a price at which you will attract people. But The remuneration package is just part of it. I think anyone who's worked full time for more than a blink of an eye recognize that there is a lot more about the quality of work and your happiness that is beyond the pay. I mean, there is a certain minimum threshold, obviously, you need to sort of pass. But beyond that, I know a lot of people who would happily take a 20, 30 grand pay cut if it meant that I have much better working conditions and or a much better boss or, any of these things. Culture is massive. I've said before that the core role of a CEO is capital allocation and setting the culture because culture is that fuzzy, intangible thing that I can't really get an accurate read on from the outside, but I know that it's vitally important. Yep. Give me, what's the saying? It's like you can give a bunch of sailors all this, incentive in the world, whip them, make them build the boat, but make them yearn for the sea and they will work for you tirelessly. I've completely butchered that reference, but I think you know the one.
This is one of my favorite quotes. My wife's a school teacher and an education consultant. This is one of her favorite quotes too. It is, if you want to build a ship, here we go. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea.
That's so much more poetic than how I said it. Yes.
Oh, it is just gorgeous.
But it is true. And you see this. It's one of the other reasons why I like small companies is you have that. I shouldn't be too general, but it's more like when you work for a massive, 20,000 employee company, you're just a cog in the machine. When you're one of 40 people and you all know each other very well and you work day and night and you've got a mission, right? You're solving problems and there's a big financial reward for you and all, those people don't need to be incentivized. I mean, they're incentivized already. And as you say, that there is nothing more powerful than a capable person who is hungry to achieve. And
right, meaning and purpose.
Yes,
it's just meaning and purpose. It's you mentioned culture. Peter Drucker famously said, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast."
Yes,
and it just does because you can have all the best PowerPoints in the world.
Yep,
and you can publish them, and people go, "Oh, that's an amazing PowerPoint. That's a great strategy." Does it get executed? Do people actually care? I'll give my company a wrap. I joined the Motley Fool 13 years ago, and I've said before, I took a pretty decent pay cut to do it. I did it because I wanted to be part of something, and the company's not perfect, but we're genuinely trying to do this podcast for free, right? We're trying to help people, learn a bit, help themselves, be better investors, have a better financial future. That meaning and purpose is what gets me out of bed. I might have had one maybe in the last 13 years. I used to have, worked for other companies where the Sunday night, you'd be like, oh, I got to go to work tomorrow. The week starts at 6 o'clock on a Sunday night because that's when you start thinking about work. It's like, oh, bloody hell.
Yeah.
I love coming to work and not because the work's always great, not because I do love all my colleagues, but because I feel like we're building something, we're doing something meaningful. And I have a reasonable, productive, positive role in that. That is worth meaningful amounts of money. Speaking of working
I remember, home. Just a quick behind the curtain for those listening, I remember when I worked with you as well. I don't think I've got a memory of the boss like forcing you to take a holiday. Scott, take some time. And then you were like still sending articles through. I was like, what is this guy doing? You very much had a yearning for the sea, very much so.
Well, that's it, right? And I think I love your small company example, actually, mate, because to bring it back to investing, I think that's so true. You've talked about the quote professional manager before as opposed to the founder who kind of, runs the business. They kind of run it as well as they think they can and they try and do all the right things. They try and make these businesses successful. And I don't doubt their intent necessarily, but there's such a difference between someone who, the hired gun will always do what they can.
Mm-hmm.
The person who lives, breathes, gave birth to this thing. Think about Graham Turner at Flight Center, right? Mm-hmm. Frankly, Mike Cannon-Brookes or Scott Farquhar at Atlassian. Pick any. I mean, I love founder owners. It's always a shame when someone moves on. Bezos at Amazon, I own shares in. Mm-hmm. Give me a couple others, mate. Give me some founder owner companies you like.
Jumbo Interactive, Mike. Is it Viverka? Nice. I've gone blank now. Yeah. I mean, again, there's no coincidence. A lot of these companies tend to do pretty well. Digger Data's got a very enigmatic CEO, but it's done very well.
David Dicker.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence.
That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah. So I think that's, that's where it comes
from. Oh, sorry, mate. Sorry, we've got a bit of a lag. I think it would take a lot for me to invest in an AGL or a Telstra. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But a big part of the reason is just the inertia of the culture. Companies get to a size where they are so big and so bureaucratic that they get a bloat to them, which is very, very difficult to get out of. Remember when Sol Trujillo took over Telstra and he was like, oh, I'm going to change the whole structure. And then like, well, how did that work out? Right. Like, then like maybe, maybe he wasn't very effective or maybe it was an impossible task. Yeah.
Well, you can't turn him. You just, what's it like 10 miles to turn oil tanker or something stupid? Like it's really, really difficult. By the way, speaking of culture, that's also why as you're growing a business and maybe most of our listeners won't be doing that, but you want to make sure the culture as you grow, because by the time you've realized you made a mistake, by the time you get to that oil tanker, it's like, oh man, I wish when we were just a little, runabout tinny, I'd made some changes then, because as it grew, those things became calcified. I've worked for a very large food company. And when I got there, it was just the most depressing, calcified experience. Not even depressing in terms of bureaucracy and management, that can be depressing in itself. It was almost Stockholm syndrome. We can't do that here. We don't do that here.
Why not?
Too hard.
We've always done it that way. But why?
Literally. We tried that. Yeah. Well, there was the other one. I was like, oh, what should this? We tried that when? About 5 years ago.
Soul destroying.
All right. Well, let's not try. I made it literally. I kid you not. This thing was just absolutely miserable. And it was such a shame because these had great consumer brands. And that was the other thing. There was no crisis yet. Because they were sailing through on the basis of things that they'd done before. And that's the other thing for investors is just be careful about some of the competitive advantages you think you see. Because they can mask over. For quite a while, you can kind of get away with it, right? You can ride on the coattails of what's been done. That, speaking of the oil tanker, you turn the engine off, it'll probably keep coasting for 10 miles too. You go, oh, look, that's going pretty well. All of a sudden, 10 miles later, it's like stopped dead in the water. It's like, oh. So, be careful of that too. But yeah, as much as I don't do as much small company investing as you do, mate, I think you're absolutely right. I love finding companies run by their founders or people who are, essentially founders. Buffett at Berkshire. The company's founded 100 years before he turned up, but he runs it as if he owns it because he owns most of it, large minority shareholding. But people who have it in their DNA is just a huge, huge, huge difference. And by the way, those people are much less likely to want people to return to the office so they can look over their shoulders.
Yep.
They're probably going to say, here's what we're doing, let's go and do it.
Yep.
They've probably got less fat and less bad people they've probably hired in the first place too.
Yep. I'll give you a great story. This is before work from home was a thing because the technology didn't really exist. But one of the very first proper jobs that I had, it's a big organization and we'd go through, even in the relatively short time I was there, we'd go through these cycles of like firing everyone because they got worried about costs. And then 6 months later, they'd hire everyone again. It's crazy. I remember the 4 or 5 years I was there, it was like, this is really dumb. Anyway, one time it came around that it was just like, they're making some redundancies. We don't know if this department is going to be where I was at the time. It was like, oh, okay. So what do you want me to do? I was like, we don't want you to do anything right now. I was like, okay, can I go home? I was very young at the time, right? So I'm in my 20s, like, all right, sweet, let's go. No, 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 we need you to stay here. Okay, what do you want me to do? Just sit at your desk. Like, can I help the mailroom? Can I do something? No, we just want you. Okay. And then I got told off for like, because I think I was scrolling the Sydney Morning Herald or something on the computer. It's like, no, 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 you can't do that here. And like, this is madness, right? This is insane. This is just suffering for the point of suffering. You're paying me. I get that. Get me to do something productive. And if not, like send me home. Correct. But the point is that I'm trying to be careful not to dox the company here, but it was sort of known as a bit of a trading ground for the industry. Right. And the staff turnover was relentless, partly because of their actions, but also, let me tell you this, anyone with any capability was not there long. As long as they had enough to sort of on their CV to say, I worked here for a little bit. And so, you know who stayed? The people who didn't have other options.
Exactly.
And, look, not that I feel particularly bad for this company. They've done very well for various other reasons. But, but they any talent that they would bring in, they would lose very quickly because of what they were paying decent industry award rates, just not treating their staff very well. I was like, it has a consequence. So, from what, full circle here, everything you've said has just made me even less want to invest in AGL.
There we go. Got there in the end. Mate, we've rattled on for long enough. I reckon we should come back on Sunday, answer some viewer, listener questions. Yeah. What do you reckon?
Yeah, 100%. Let's do it.
All right, we will do that. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your weekend, unless you're listening on a Tuesday at lunchtime, in which case you've got a couple of days to go. I'm sorry about that. But until Sunday, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.